The following talk is offered freely to ensure that no one is ever denied access to these practices and to these teachings. If you feel inspired to make a donation to support this offering, you can go to my website at jonathanfaust.com. While you're there, you can also sign up for a monthly newsletter designed to support you in your practice. Thank you, and enjoy.
After the devastating fires in Northern California, a Zen teacher by the name of John Tarrant wrote this. In the burned houses, fireproof safes survived. Sometimes the only other thing intact was high-fired ceramic. A chimney, a big flower pot with white glaze and blue flowers. The tumblers on the safe still worked, and the door swung open nicely. Inside, there was a puddle of metal that had been Grandma's rings or Granddad's watch. The papers, the stock certificates, Bitcoin codes, titles to the house and car, of these, there was no trace. A fireproof safe saves nothing but itself. This tells about our relationship to things in a different way. Loss is also a true and surprising road. We can't negotiate with our moment. It has an irrevocable quality. One way or another, we just have to enter into it. If you have ever had the fortune to be with someone as they die, there is that amazing moment when they're there and then they're not. It's a profound moment to see the inherent emptiness, if you will. And I'd like to talk a little bit about emptiness and why it is such a critical part of practice. And it's easy to get lost in the philosophy of it, so I'd like to turn a little more toward the pragmatic quality of it and explore a little bit about how the awareness of emptiness can not only shape your practice, but may be helpful in your life. So I'll talk a little bit about the concept of emptiness and how you can explore it in your practice, and how to embrace emptiness. Always, when I have a talk to give, I'm usually gifted by some horrible experience that makes it all relevant for me. Last week, I ran across something on the internet and emailed it to a family member. And I thought it was a rather thoughtful and kind email, saying, "Hey, I remember talking about this last year, and you might be interested. And here's the information." And in my meditation, I realized that I never got an acknowledgement or a thank you. That shouldn't be a really big deal, but for some reason, it just triggered a flash of anger. I think because I was slowed down and paying attention. And part of that flash of anger was this sense of, well, there it goes again. You know, I'm not being acknowledged. You know, I'm not being seen by my family of origin. And this person can't even take a moment to type back, "Hey, thanks, that was helpful," or anything like that. And then it just proliferated. And this goes on and on, and coming up with other incidents of feeling, kind of not seen, not heard, contemplating what a jerk this other person was, and realized how angry I was getting. Like a really deep-seated, it wasn't like a... The anger was a very young anger. You know, it was like a very young core family of origin kind of stuff. So not only angry, but also kind of embarrassed that I was having that experience. And so I've trained myself to really investigate when the demons arise to have tea with them. And so I was just saying, you know, well, I'm hurt. You know, I feel hurt. And then I thought to myself, well, who is it that's hurt? Can I find who that is hurt and angry right now? And just by asking that question, something shifted. And suddenly I just saw the story. You know, here's the story that has been repeated over and over again through these decades of my life. And then suddenly I thought, well, wait a minute, who am I without this story? And then suddenly there was this expansiveness, a real sense of it was pleasure that kind of led to bliss. And then once again, I was hearing the birds and feeling my body and feeling my breath. And there is something quite profound in that experience of seeing how utterly, deeply identified I was with the fact that I didn't get this response to my email, seeing the proliferation of the story, and then looking for who that person was that was feeling it, and then asking, well, who am I without the story? It was like flipping a switch from being a very tightly bound being to a real sense of the mystery. And suddenly that tight story just seemed like a little speck of dust off in the distance. Have you ever noticed in your meditation practice how you can be completely knotted up about some issue in your practice? And then 30 minutes after your meditation, you can't remember what that was? That was so important. We have such an identification with our thinking process and who we are as these storytellers. And of course, you are so much more than that. So when we talk about emptiness in practice or how we live our life, the concept of emptiness can be confusing because emptiness implies that there's a nothingness out there, which is really not what it's saying. It's not negating anything or taking anything away, but it's a filter. It's a way of looking at your experience. What emptiness says is that when you look at the self and you look at phenomena, there's no real inner essence to anything that occurs. And we'll explore this a little bit more. Just as you're listening to sound, the sound is just phenomena coming through. A story arises from it. Well, it sounds like that person's driving too fast, or whatever story may be going on. But it's that difference between listening through the mind and just experiencing sound vibration. It's listening through the filter of judging, planning, figuring things out, and the raw data of what's happening, that quality of bare attention. So the practice of mindfulness, or as I like to think of it as non-judging awareness, is a vehicle for stepping out of the thinking process. When you step back from your experience, and perhaps in this last half hour you had a number of moments when you realized you were kind of wrapped up around something that's going to happen tomorrow or replaying a memory. Something in your awareness was aware that you were thinking, and then you brought yourself back to the raw data of here and now, to sound or breath. You stepped away from that thinking process. And in essence, what you're doing is you're stepping away from the concept of I and mine. And this is an important piece in exploring liberation, exploring inherent emptiness. And it goes back to something the Buddha said, where he said that nothing whatsoever is to be clung to as I or mine. Nothing whatsoever is to be clung to as I or mine. When I reflect on that, and I think about the times when I've experienced real happiness, or real euphoria, or that sense of flow, when you're in that flow state, the sense of I and mine isn't there, or it's very porous. When you're not identified with that tight sense of I and mine, but you're just open to this organic, natural happening in the moment. So when you practice meditation and you're lost in thought and you realize, oh, that's just the thought form. Let me come back. You're stepping away from I and mine. And when you do that, something begins to free up on the inside. You begin to believe less and less in that cognitive process. Of course, you can't stop it. The cognitive process is very useful. Most of us make our money by using it and using it well. But when you're not identified with it, something frees up inside in a pretty dramatic way. We base our lives on this sense of self, on our story. And there's nothing wrong with that, except for when we get attached. So there are all kinds of teachings around emptiness and the sense of self. And there's a story, one of the classic stories is the story of Bahia, who was an ardent practitioner of meditation back in the Buddha's day. And he heard of the Buddha's teachings, and he walked a long distance to speak with the Buddha. And he asked him, what is the essence of your teaching? There's a whole classical thing in the Buddhist literature of how the Buddha would never respond unless you asked him three times. So he was quite insistent. You know, teach me the essence of the teachings. And so then the Buddha stopped and he said this. He said, in reference to the seen, there will be only the seen. In reference to the heard, only the heard. In reference to the senses, only the senses. In reference to the cognized, only the cognized. This is how you should train yourself. When for you there will be only the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the senses in reference to the senses, only the cognized in reference to the cognized, then Bahia, there is no you in connection with that. When there is no you in connection with that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between the two. This, just this, is the end of stress. So in some ways he's saying Don't add anything to your experience. Just see it as it is. So let's do a little reflection on this, kind of try this on internally. So if you like, you can close your eyes. And again, you might like to turn your attention to sound. And again, you might explore this distinction between filtering the sound through the mind, or you're identifying the source, giving it a name, maybe making up a story about it, and experiment with just experiencing sound vibration. In Zen practice, it's called bare attention. You might sense the perception of light beyond your closed eyes. Is it possible to experience it directly? What senses are most predominant right now? Can you feel them without making them good or bad? But just to experiencing them directly. You may notice the spontaneous thought forms. Is it possible to be the witness of them without adding anything or taking anything away? Can you sense all the phenomena happening without you doing anything? If you like, you can deepen the breath and if you like, you can let your eyes open or feel free to remain with them closed. In your practice, when you begin to look for the self, when you begin to look for where you are, there are a couple places you can look for it. You can look for who you are in the body, in the form. You can explore the feeling that arises from the form. You can explore whether, well, maybe who you are is the perception of the feeling and form. Or maybe you're the mental activity that's aware of feeling, form, and perception. Or maybe you're the consciousness of it all. It becomes a very interesting inquiry in your practice. Where is awareness? I believe it was the Greeks who thought there was the homunculus, this idea of a little person in there who was sort of managing everything, and that's where the self is. But it becomes a fascinating inquiry to inquire, where is awareness? Can you find it in the body and form and feeling and perception? The one thing we can rely on is that stress and suffering will arise when you cling to anything. So the question becomes, when you experience fear, can you let it wash through? When anger arises, can you let it wash through? And in my experience of sitting in meditation, of going on and on around my family history and all those old wounds and not feeling seen and not feeling heard, could I just experience that psychobiological phenomena passing through as a wave? It was only when I could disidentify a little bit that I could actually allow that to happen. Research has shown that a pure emotion lasts about 90 seconds. If you can simply experience it in its pure form. Have you ever seen little kids and the different emotions they can feel? It's amazing how many they can feel, how fully they feel them, and they can be angry one moment and then happily playing the next. Because there isn't that tightly held sense of self to the story. So when you're exploring this sense of inherent emptiness, of how nothing has any internal essence itself, the one major refuge, if you will, is that sense of awareness that you're cultivating in mindfulness or non-judging awareness. That quality of awareness that understands that this is the present moment. That sense of being completely here. And when you're completely here, you are less attached. You're less swayed by the reactive quality of your mind. So, opening to this sense of inherent emptiness for some can feel kind of scary, for some it can feel kind of liberating. But the question really is, when you begin to explore the mystery of your life, what can you count on? If you want to be really happy, what's the best strategy? There are lots of solutions, apparent solutions. There are some religious traditions out there that say, join us and surrender to what we tell you to think and everything will be okay. You know, believe these thoughts, act the way we tell you. Don't look outside the framework of what we're telling you and you'll be okay. And many find a certain kind of refuge in that. Often there's wonderful like ethical behavior that is part of different traditions. But again, when you look into the nature of reality, if the object of your investigation is what is real, it's very helpful to reflect on those three qualities, the three characteristics of reality. That if you look closely at the phenomena of your life, you'll see into the nature of impermanence, or anicca. How anything that is born of causes and conditions will change. Seeing that can be a direct doorway to greater freedom. Everything changes. The second characteristic is about your relationship to what's changing. Or dukkha, that when you try to control your experience, when you react, if something is changing and you don't want it to, or something isn't changing and you want it to the degree you want that, to that degree you will feel stress and suffering and dissatisfaction. To the degree you can let it be, you'll experience a greater sense of ease. And the third quality is seeing how inherently impersonal all of this phenomena is. It points toward the quality of anatta. And the word anatta is self, and the A is sort of a negation, so it's not self. So the questions are really noticing, well, what is changing in my life right now? What is changing in this moment? Can I let it be? Can I let it flow? Can I not interfere with this moment, but be awake to it fully? Those are those qualities that when you can invoke those qualities, they can lead to a sense of real happiness. And it's helpful to reflect on three kinds of happiness. One is what we could call a worldly happiness. And that's in living a commitment to kindness and non-harming. And it arises to pleasant conditions. I believe a lot of the original texts talk about the kinds of conditions that are wished for, desirable, and agreeable. And that points toward karma, toward cause and effect. If you are kind, chances are good that you'll receive more kindness in your life. If you are serving others, chances are you'll feel in some way served, doing unto others. Another quality of happiness, another result of your practice, is the happiness that comes from having a collected mind. That when you can take this caffeinated chipmunk of a mind and actually call it to the here and now and sustain that quality of collecting, there's a profound happiness that occurs. This is often referred to in the classic teachings as the jhana states. These are states of concentration that sort of transcend the worldly pleasures, but are intensely pleasurable and blissful. So it's cultivating concentration. And a third quality of happiness is the happiness that comes from freedom, from release, from being free of your own inherent suffering. And with that, the pleasure that comes in helping others find their freedom. I think we all have kind of this long-term goal of being free from our stress, being free from suffering, experiencing that sense of real abiding happiness, no matter what the externals. And my sense is that we experience that in glimpses, perhaps. Those moments when you find yourself caught in conflict and something in you says, well, let me just step back. And you realize that you don't have to react, you can actually respond. The moments when you feel gratitude, when you feel appreciation, the random happy attacks that can show up from time to time. Those are wonderful indicators of increasing your capacity for happiness. In essence, it is being less caught by the three afflictions, if you will. Being less caught in greed and wanting. Being less caught in aversion and anger, and being less caught in confusion. so much of our life is about stimulus and response. Something happens and you react. What this practice can do is open up that gap between stimulus and response. And that can make the difference. One thing that I have noticed, and just having the gift of working with people who are deep in their practice, is to watch the unwinding that occurs. And sometimes there can just be a gradual sense of feeling less stress, feeling a little more ease. Sometimes there are dramatic events when you recognize how attached you are to something and you see the possibility of letting it go and the deep freedom that comes with it. But I've also noticed that as you practice and you find that there is more freedom, there's less identification with the stories in your life, that you have more and more of a capacity to really see that all the phenomena arising are just phenomena unto themselves. That part of that unwinding sort of takes you back to the really core issues in your life. In my own family structure, like going back to my experience of meditation around not getting my email responded to and getting angry, is a real recognition there's something fundamentally at the core of my conditioning. That sense of not being seen and not being heard, you know, the middle child syndrome, if you will, that there's an inherent distrust that is somewhere inside of me. And the more that I can really slow down and sense how I react to life, how I anticipate life, what the practice has helped me to do is to really sense that very, very subtle and yet foundational quality of distrust, and then to explore that. That has really helped me to find freedom in subtle ways I hadn't noticed before. And that's what makes the practice so rich. That when you stop, you slow down, you decide to bring your attention to the here and now, you notice all the ways your conditioning takes you away from the here and now. You come back, you re-relax, you re-arrive. Over time, you become less and less identified with the phenomena. You're more and more capable of resting in the here and now. And that unwinding gets more and more subtle. It's the unpeeling of an onion. And ultimately, it can lead to a real greater sense of freedom. So much of the practice is around letting go. Particularly when you are practicing meditation with a busy day and you're watching the mind. Noticing the mental formations and sensing if you can let them go. Noticing the obsessing of the next thing on your agenda. Seeing it, sensing if you can relax around it. Meditation becomes a time when you can explore who you are as the observer of all this phenomena. And it can give you a real sense of freedom. So freedom is possible in the practice. We taste it in different ways. But when you begin to sense, well, how much of phenomena is really empty, The other side of the coin, in seeing kind of the inherent emptiness of everything, can lead to a sense of, well, is this nihilism? Is it just nothing really matters? And I think one of the greatest treatises on nihilism is the Coen brothers, The Big Lebowski, one of my favorites. How do we respond to the mystery of life? Well, if you've seen the movie, you know that the dude abides. You know, he surrenders. Some call him lazy, but maybe that's actually enlightenment. You know, there's actually a church, it's called the Church of the Latter-day Dude, that was formed in 2006. Remembers his friend Walter, you know, who took out a gun because someone was breaking the rule in the bowling tournament, preparing for the bowling tournament. Well, some of us, we adhere to laws. That's our relationship to the mystery. You remember the other Lebowski, his whole life was about seeking fame and being someone important and being respected. His daughter Maud was just creating art for art's sake. And others in the movie are just responding to animal impulses. One of the most powerful retreats that I've done was really exploring all of your stories. You'd sort of tell all of your stories till you just got sick of them. And then at the end, they said, here's the punchline of this whole exploration of our personal narratives and the drama of our life. And the instructor said, if nothing means anything, including this statement, what do you want to do? So let me pose that question for you within the minutes that we have remaining. If you like, you can close your eyes. When you sense the mystery of your life, when you turn your attention to who and what you are, when you sense perhaps in your own life or in your own practice that when you can disengage from identification with the thinking process, that there is a sense of freedom. When you reflect on the moments in your life when that sense of a tightly held I and mine has either fallen away or been porous, and you have kind of sensed the flow or the mystery of your life. If nothing means anything, including this statement, what do you want to do with your life? What do you feel? What do you notice as you contemplate that question? And if you'd like, you can deepen your breath or you can remain with the eyes closed. When you sense the mystery of life, Mahatma Gandhi once said that you must live your life as if each day was your last and as if you were going to live forever. So why is this sense of emptiness important? What does emptiness of self mean? In one way, it means there's no self to defend. That you can see that the seeds of your stress and your suffering don't need to be defended. There's nothing you can hold on to, which can lead to a release of clinging. And it may open up a greater sense of possibility in your life. It can mean that you can stay open to your life, to stay open to the mystery. When we are identified with a tightly held sense of I and mine, life becomes about control. The bandwidth of your life gets narrower and narrower. And when you practice, when you cultivate non-judging awareness, the bandwidth can get wider. It can increase your capacity for greater calm and for more trust and more faith and more of a capacity to embrace the mystery of this wild life that you're living. There's a wonderful book, if you're interested in reading more about emptiness, by Guy Armstrong. It's just called Emptiness. It's a really wonderful treatise, kind of exploring kind of its origins and takes you into some of the original literature and so forth. So thank you for your attention to this. A few quick things. There is an after-class discussion group, which is a really wonderful thing if you'd like to check it out. It meets right across from the restrooms in the boardroom there. I'm going to be leading a day-long retreat on March 10th. It's called Dynamic Meditation. It's a very embodied practice, a very non-traditional form of meditation in the morning, and then we'll do the classical stuff in the afternoon. It's also referred to as the blow-out-the-tubes meditation, so any tension you want to blow out, this will take care of that. There's also, of course, yoga happening beforehand. And there's a family retreat. There's an annual family retreat. And I'll send more information out. But that's on the website. I was asked to announce that as well. And if you're feeling particularly empty after this reflection on emptiness, there are cookies to help fill you up again. So that'll be important.